You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC. I'm Julie Burstein in for Leonard Lopate on this very warm Thursday afternoon. In 2006, a young novice journalist moved to Pakistan with his wife, and he spent 2 years writing about the madrasas, conflicts, and clerics he encountered there in stories for Slate, The New Republic, and The New York Times Magazine. Nicholas Schmidl writes about many of these stories in his new book, To Live or Perish Forever, Two Tumultuous Years in Pakistan. It's published by Henry Holt. Nicholas Schmidl is currently a fellow at the New America Foundation, and I'm pleased to welcome him to the Leonard Lopate Show today. Welcome.
Thanks, Julie. Thanks for having me on.
Now, I think a good place to start is actually at the end of your journey in Pakistan. Can you tell us how you came to leave that country?
Well, the first time or the second time, I left sort of under something like official deportation in January of 2008, and then I went back in August of 2008 and left after I was reading reports in the press that I'd been kidnapped.
Well, I think both stories would be interesting, but the official deportation first. This is after your initial 2 years. What happened?
Right. So in January of 2008, 2 days after I had published a piece in the New York Times Magazine called Next Gen Taliban, that was sort of a profile of this emergent Pakistani Taliban. 2 days after that piece came out, I had five police officers that knocked on my door one cold, rainy evening and handed me a deportation order saying that my visa and my wife's visa had been canceled. We were essentially living in Pakistan illegally, and, you know, sort of whatever happens next if you're living in a country illegally. So they said that they would give us an hour to leave. And fortunately, my wife, she was the nutritionist at the five-star hotel in Islamabad. And fortunately, she had some contacts, so she made a call, and one of her overweight clients happened at that moment to be playing bridge with Musharraf's national security advisor. So that bought us 48 extra hours to get out of the country and give us time to sort of pack our bags and give someone our cat and sell our car.
What was it in that story that, and do you think it was the story that precipitated 4 days later people coming to your door and saying, you have to leave now?
Right. I mean, the story featured a lot of reporting, a lot of exclusive reporting on the Pakistani Taliban. I spent some time in Quetta, the capital of Balochistan province, which is where many people believe Mullah Omar and many of the Afghan Taliban are based. I also spent some time in the Swat Valley at the peak, really, when the Taliban, under Maulana Fazlullah's control, were exerting their influence. The government and the local police and local security services had totally disappeared. And I spent several days there as more or less a guest of the Taliban, and on the third day witnessed a public lashing. The Taliban had erected this platform and marched these three criminals up onto the platform. And
what were their crimes?
Their crimes were allegedly involvement in a kidnapping plot. And so this is sort of the way that the Pakistani Taliban moved into SWAT was by presenting themselves as the sort of vanguard of law and order, and that they were going to reintroduce swift justice and do it according to strict Sharia law.
Now, is it unusual for journalists to be deported in this kind of abrupt fashion from Pakistan?
It's not unusual for journalists to be harassed, and there have been several instances over the past several years where the intelligence agencies have stormed hotel rooms, made very threatening phone calls. There have been a couple of deportations, but it's relatively rare. You know, we had been living there for so long, for 2 years, that there was also a weird sort of relationship, if you will, that we had with our host, which is I worked at this pro-government think tank. I was there on a writing fellowship, and I was there on a research visa, more or less. And I remember the woman who ran the think tank, when I first got there, she said to me, you know, you Western journalist, you don't know anything about Pakistan. You come here, you never leave Islamabad, you don't speak Urdu, et cetera, et cetera. And about a year later, she came upstairs and walked in front of my office, and here I was wearing local clothes, speaking Urdu to the guys who served tea. And she looked at me and she said, there's no way you can be a journalist. So this is, I think, the conundrum that you know, those individuals face who kind of try and blend in a little bit more than just reporting.
Now, you say you try to blend in, but in your jacket cover and also in your book, you talk about how just in terms of who you are, it's very difficult to blend in. Can you talk a little bit about the lengths you went to try not to stand out as much?
Well, it varied. I mean, one of the main things when I was in the Northwest Frontier Province in Swat and in places like Banu and Deir Esma Khan, these cities that are just outside of the tribal areas, was not to speak English in public. You know, as I'm traveling with a fixer, to kind of be, if we're in the markets, to be trying to speak in Urdu, because from a distance, if I'm wearing local clothes and most of the people, most of the Pashtuns who live along the border are relatively fair-skinned, so from a distance, you would be able to see that I wasn't from there necessarily, but it wouldn't jump out that I was necessarily an American. Increasingly as well, in the fall of 2007, as I was reporting this New York Times Magazine story, I began also relying on good old number 36 Revlon to dye my hair a little bit before I went into these areas. So my wife would come in, and she'd come into the house, and she could hear me back in the bathroom messing around. She said, "What are you doing?" She said, "This should be a rule. If you feel the need, like you have to dye your hair because you're going someplace, that should be a good indication that you shouldn't go there at all."
Well, that's, you know, one of the questions I had as I read your book is, you write about going towards tear gas and gunshots. And what did you say to yourself in those moments when you were heading towards what you knew was going to be a dangerous situation, where most of us would probably be running the other way?
Well, I think that it's so relative, and it when you're there, it seems so much less risky than when I'm sitting here. And
how so? That's really interesting. I mean, you went to a country where a journalist, Daniel Pearl, had been murdered.
Right.
So you say when you were on the ground, it felt less risky to you?
For sure. I think that my comfort level adjusts. You establish contacts that you perhaps give too much faith and trust in, but nonetheless, you feel pretty safe in the presence of these people. And, you know, amidst the sort of chaos from 10 feet away seems much more manageable than chaos from 10,000 miles away. And in that, if there's a street protest going on, I can sort of see everyone, and I can try and see sort of what's the nature of where the people are pushing, or where are the gunshots coming from, or where's the tear gas coming from. Whereas sitting here in Washington, I think there's no way I really know that. And so you just kind of get a little bit more of that. You can begin to develop something like a gut feeling when you've been on the ground for that long.
You, as you talked about, were able to go to areas where the Taliban were very involved. How did you gain access to these places that most Western journalists were not allowed?
A couple of different ways. I mean, the first way was just establishing a good network of local translators and fixers who are, when it comes to this sort of reporting, by far the unheralded heroes. I mean, I would not have been able to get anywhere without the four, five, six guys who, you know, I sort of had a local fixer in each town or each district of the Northwest Frontier Province in Baluchistan. So rather than taking a fixer or a translator from Islamabad and bringing them down there, I would always have guys who had a good network of local contacts. The second way, and so they would also be able to already have made the introductions to the Taliban or made the introductions to whatever sort of militant leaders we were trying to meet with.
How did they do their job? Because in a sense, they're the bridge from one culture to another.
Right. You know, they're you're right. They're in a very unenviable position where they're essentially trying to bring together two people who would, under other circumstances, perhaps be trying to kill one another, or their larger identity groups, whether it's Americans or whether it's Taliban or whether it's Afghans, are literally trying to kill each other at that moment. So you've got two individuals that are brought out of these two belligerent groups that are trying to meet. And the fixer, you know, when I went into SWAT, my fixer told all the Taliban that I was a Canadian journalist. And, you know, of course, they've heard this a million times before. They know that American journalists always say they're Canadian. And so I remember when I met one of the militants right off, he'd lived in Boston. You know, he immediately looked at me and he sort of said, you know, which American newspaper do you work for? There was no two doubts about it.
I'm speaking with Nicholas Schmidl. He has written a book called To Live or to Perish Forever, Two Tumultuous Years in Pakistan. Now, you also talk about the people in Islamabad that you met who were very helpful in getting you connected to the people outside of the city.
Right. Yeah, well, that was that's what I was just going to mention, is that perhaps the most crucial and important window that I had into this world of jihadi politics, not only in Pakistan, but really in Bangladesh as well, sort of across the region, was this individual named Abdul Rashid Ghazi, who was the head of the Red Mosque in Islamabad, which in July of 2007 was stormed by Pakistani army commandos, and Abdul Rashid Ghazi was killed. But up until then, for about the year and a half leading up to that, I met with Ghazi on a regular basis. And he, for some unexplainable reason, was incredibly candid and very open with me, and we would sit and talk for hours about his relationship with Osama bin Laden, about his beliefs of the imminent Islamic revolution that was coming to Pakistan. And then before I would leave his office, and I'd say, oh, you know, I'm going now to Bangladesh next week, or I'm going to Karachi, or I'm going here, there. And I had asked him if he knew anyone, and sure enough, he would write, you know, his name on the back of one of his business cards, sign it, give it to me, and then tell me the phone number and the name of someone in whatever city I was going to, and say, you know, look that person up, and they should help you. And so having Ghazi's business card with his signature was like having the golden ticket into the wild world of radical Islam, if you will. And so that was a really a critical link. And after he was killed, I wrote an op-ed piece for Slate that was later republished in the Washington Post and then was later translated in a lot of Urdu newspapers. And the piece was very much, it was an obituary to someone like a fallen friend. And it was me sort of talking through the moral complexities of wondering whether you're allowed to mourn for a jihadi who's just died, who just led a sort of a mini Islamic revolution in the middle of the capital, but by the same token, someone who was a friend. And so this article was also very helpful because it humanized Ghazi. And so when we went to meet militants later, we could say, oh, you know, I'm sure you read that article. And they'd say, yes, yes, we read it. And say, well, I'm the author. And that was also, so Ghazi's connections continued to bear fruit even after he was killed.
You touch upon something I'd wanted to ask about, which is that moral complexity. And reading the book, I can sense your friendship for these people who in other circumstances, I would assume you would be questioning their motives and what it is they're trying to bring about. How did you negotiate that with yourself?
I think that you almost had to suspend some sort of some beliefs, if you will. My father is a Marine general. My brother is a Marine lieutenant who was, at the time that I was in Pakistan, serving in Iraq, fighting jihadis in Alambar province. And so it was always there in the back of my mind. But by the same token, if I was going to be able to report on Pakistan in a way that would provide some importance, if you will, to the American public and to sort of American policymakers and be able to give them a more granular idea of what was going on in Pakistan, I was going to have to cross that line and be able to sort of empathize with these guys to get them to open up. And I remember there was one night in the Swat Valley, and we were sitting having dinner with one of these local Talib commanders, and after dinner he whipped out his cell phone and he began showing me all these short video clips of Taliban and Al-Qaeda blowing up American convoys in Iraq and Afghanistan. And it was very uncomfortable, and so I tried to change the subject, and we began talking about Islamic philosophy a little bit. And he then said to me, well, do you know that Osama bin Laden has written a philosophy book? And I said, no, I haven't. He said, come with me. So he takes me into this other room, a side room, and we're in this log cabin in the middle of the forest, 2 hours away from the nearest city in Swat. And he has this bookshelf that has all this sort of Al-Qaeda paraphernalia and various guns that jihadi luminaries have given him and whatnot. And at the bottom is a knapsack, and he says, actually, the philosophy book is in that knapsack, but I promised the person who left that knapsack I wouldn't touch it until he came back. And I nudged our host, and I, you know, kind of was giving him a hard time, saying, all right, well, you know, who's the person you're so worried about? And he said, well, this bag was left by Ayman al-Zawahiri, Al-Qaeda's number two. And I looked at him, and I thought, all right, I would probably also honor that request. And at that point, I went back into the other room, made eye contact with my local journalist friend, and said, I think it's probably time for us to start motoring our way back into town. Just got this very sinking feeling like there had been some seriously dangerous people in that same room in the not-so-recent past.
I'm speaking with freelance journalist Nicholas Schmidl about his book, To Live or to Perish Forever, Two Tumultuous Years in Pakistan. It's published by Henry Holt & Company, and we'll be back with more after a break. I'm Julie Burstein. I'm in today for Leonard Lopate, and I'm speaking with Nicholas Schmidl, who has written a book called To Live or to Perish Forever, Two Tumultuous Years in Pakistan. Nicholas, you were talking about your trip to the Swat Valley. Can you describe for our listeners what it looks like and what the people there are like beyond the perhaps including the Taliban, but also beyond the Taliban? How do people live? What is it like there?
Right. Well, the Swat Valley is gorgeous. It is it's referred to as the Switzerland of South Asia, and it is it's the foothills of the Hindu Kush Mountains, pine covered mountains and pine forest covered mountains, and the Swat River meanders through the middle of the valley. It's very lush. I'm spacing on the name of the fruit. Apple orchards though, and persimmon orchards, and the people there are very soft and very gentle and very kind, in fact. And Swat, the sort of confusing thing about Swat, why the Taliban came up, was because the people also are very educated. There are universities there. It's very rich, and there is a very rich legacy of poetry. And people do live very simplistically. It's very conservative. And so increasingly what you saw when the Taliban were coming into power was that women were, in the beginning, just confined to the markets, and they weren't really wandering out. But Maulana Fazlullah, who was the Taliban leader, using his radio station, began proclaiming that women shouldn't be seen in the markets at all. And men at this point had to take over all of the shopping duties. And when we were there, we heard these men complaining, saying, oh, you know, this is, we're sort of, we're, you know, we're trying to follow Sharia law, and we're trying to do this, and it's good in that sense, but by the same token, these shopping duties are really getting to me. He says, not only do I have to, you know, pick out dinner, but then I also have to buy my wife's brassieres during the day and all this. And it was a pretty funny moment.
It's funny, but it's also very troubling. And I have to say, one of the things that was troubling to me about your book is it really is a book about men. Mm. And here is a country that was at one point led by a woman. But I think I only encountered one woman in the entire book.
Right.
Did you find that women really were relegated to home and the background, and were you able to meet any?
That's a fantastic question, in fact. I said something to my wife about half the way through our 2 years there. I said, you know, I never learned how to speak Urdu with using the feminine, because I never had any interactions with women. And my wife, on the other hand, had interactions with both men and women. And so she sort of saw this other world. And that's actually the advantage almost of being a female journalist in Pakistan, is that you are able to speak to both sexes. And as a man, it is just much, much, much more difficult. So women are out. You see women politicians, you see women in the media. But my wife's interactions with women were much more enriched, if you will. She was my wife had enrolled at the International Islamic University, and she was the only non-Muslim American to ever attend. And so it was mainly, the program was for women whose families were educated enough to realize that their daughters needed an education, but conservative enough that they weren't going to turn them off to the secular universities or leave them at the secular universities. So my wife got this incredible window into that whole world, but it was one that was relatively closed off to me.
And what did she find? How did the women she met feel about the position they held in society there?
They accepted it wholeheartedly. At one point, my wife came back. This is right around the time that Benazir Bhutto was coming back from exile. And they were asked a question in class whether, according to Islam, a woman can rule a Muslim country. Can a woman order men into war? And these girls, these educated girls, none of them raised their hand, and none of them said yes. So while they believed, you know, Benazir Bhutto was sort of almost exempt from the normal gender rules, but she was a true exception. And for the rest of society, the laws of Islam, or the perceived laws of Islam, dictated that women should not be in a leadership role.
When you were there, did you find that The stories were really different within the major metropolitan cities like Islamabad and the stories outside in places like Swat, both for men and women. Did you find that there was a kind of different interpretation of what was going on?
You did, for sure. I Islamabad is very much an echo chamber, and it's very much parlor politics. So you can meet, as a journalist, you could meet prime minister, you could meet all these dignitaries, but it was so sheltered. And I always found it much more refreshing and much more real to go out to these rural areas, or even just to get out of Islamabad, even just to go to Karachi, it felt much more real. So the stories are very different, and what you see in Islamabad is not Pakistan. They say that Pakistan starts 15 minutes away from Islamabad, which is where Rawalpindi begins.
Did you find that it conformed to your own expectations of what you were going to encounter there, or did you find that there were things that really surprised you?
Fortunately, I had absolutely no expectations. When I arrived in February of 2006, when I left my wife on Valentine's Day, 3 months after we'd been married, and said, okay, I'm going to go to Pakistan and sort of set up, and then you can come over after a month or so. You know, I had a backpack. I had one suitcase, one backpack, my computer, and I got off the airplane, and that was it. I didn't leave Pakistan for 2 years, besides some trips around the region. I never came home again. So that was, having never been there, I mean, my first impression or my first notion before the airplane, you know, the exit gate opened and we stepped into the airport, was that I was going to be torn alive. I was going to be eaten alive, literally, because there, on the flight from Dubai to Karachi, the Air Emirates TVs were showing that there were riots in Pakistan and that people were dying, and as a result of anger over the blasphemous cartoons that had been published in the Danish newspapers. And that they were going, you know, that all symbols, that all these Western symbols, fast food joints, banks were being burned. And I'm blonde, and I have occasionally in the past tried to present myself as Danish when I was traveling in Central Asia in the past. And I thought, you know what, there's no way I'm going to say I'm Danish this time. And so I got off the airplane and kind of told everyone that I was an American the first few days and reminded them that we did not publish those newspapers. But so those were my first impressions, that I was going to get off and all of a sudden this mob was going to descend on me. And, of course, it didn't happen.
It's interesting because that gets back to what you said earlier, which is from a distance it was terrifying. But when you were actually in it, you figured out a way to negotiate these challenges.
For sure.
What led you to the leader of the Red Mosque? How did you find him?
I found him through a Pakistani journalist based in Karachi, who I, when I first got there, again, really looked up to. He seemed like he was very well-sourced, and he's made a kind of an offhand comment one day that if the Pakistani Taliban ever came to power, that Abdul Rashid Ghazi could very well become the emir or the leader of the Pakistani Taliban. And I thought, well, that's pretty amazing because this guy lives a mile from my house. You know, I should really sort of find out what he's all about. And when I went and met him and realized that he was nothing like any of the other so-called jihadis that I had encountered before or after, I kind of couldn't get enough of this guy. I mean, he was very articulate. He spoke English. He looked a little like Jerry Garcia. You know, it was just this combination of this very well-connected guy that was also, was like I said, sort of very affable and warm. And he had a great sense of humor. And so he, at one point, when his vigilantes were kidnapping brothel owners in Islamabad and causing, obviously, a huge stir, someone asked him, they said, well, does this signal the Talibanization of Islamabad? And his response was, well, when Rudy Giuliani became the mayor of New York, he went after the brothels, too. Did anyone call that the Talibanization of New York City?
I think he went after them in a rather different fashion, though.
Well,
so
I would say so, too. The thing is, you had to say, okay, the analogy is not totally apt, but touche for, you know, having a foot in both worlds and being able to pull that out. So, yeah, he was, you know, like I said, worldly and worldly enough to be able to dip in and pull cultural references from around the world.
What's interesting, though, and you know, you read this about a lot of regimes that rule with this kind of terror, is that there can be a kind of benign face of the dangerous actions that actually happened. Did you find yourself questioning that? I mean, he sounds like, as you say, an affable man, but he had thugs out there who were not respecting a rule of law. So
right.
how did you balance those two things?
I always knew that he was there were sides of him that I didn't have access to. He was very close. For instance, he and the mosque and the Red Mosque were very close with there's this organization called Sepa Sahaba, which is one of the anti-Shia sectarian groups. And this, frankly, Ghazi knew that arguing why Shiites should be killed because they're infidels just doesn't, frankly, have the same, isn't going to attract the attention of, the positive attention of Western journalists, like, say, talking about, you know, kicking the foreign invaders out of Afghanistan, or trying to bring something like justice to Pakistan, or, you know, the typical lofty abstract Taliban rhetoric. And so, you know, that side I knew was shielded from me, and it wasn't really a balanced thing. I think that I just kind of went into it that I'm a blank slate. I'm trying just to report on what he says, and frankly, I've got this access that, you know, I'm not going to turn my back on.
Excuse me. Sorry about that. A listener has written into our webpage asking why you were interested in the Taliban and what did you find out about the sources of the movement and their ideological philosophy?
I think that I was interested in them because it seemed inevitable in early 2006 that this was going to become a front page issue eventually. Shortly before I arrived was when the Taliban released their first DVD showing a public hanging in North Waziristan, and this was the DVD when they proclaimed that the North Waziristan and there had been renamed the Islamic Emirate of Waziristan, and that the Taliban were now the government. So this, it just, like I said, seemed inevitable, and it seemed like something that I wanted to get ahead on. The realization, and I think this is something that's often overlooked, is how the Taliban have been able to weave various rationalizations for their movement into what is largely perceived as being just purely religious rhetoric. They have, they have wedded Pashtun nationalism along with their own interpretation of Islamic law. They have also attacked what they see as social injustices, the landlord system, the tribal system, even to some extent. And so, I mean, they have a very rhetorically, they've had a very egalitarian message, and yet, and this kind of, I think, exemplifies the difference between the Taliban as an idea and the appeal of the Taliban as an idea for many Pakistanis and the Taliban as a reality. And so you find that those people who are further from the Taliban find the Taliban more attractive than those people who are actually living in the villages where the Taliban are governing, because they find that actually these guys aren't all they say they are, and they're in fact just kind of broods.
And that public lashings may not be what they were bargaining for or looking for.
Right. Well, the thing about the public lashing, there were, at that moment in October of 2007, there was a great amount. There were 15,000 people there, and they were literally chanting off the lashings as they were going down 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. You know, counting off like the final seconds of a basketball game.
What was that like for you to watch?
It was utterly surreal, and I can't really describe it any other way, besides the fact that I had about an hour earlier met Maulana Fazlullah, who, this was in October of 2007, and no other Western journalist has met him since. He's gone underground. He was actually underground at that point. He came out and briefly introduced himself and assigned his top bodyguard to guard myself and this local journalist for the day to make sure that no one messed with us.
And was this under his order that these lashings were taking place?
Exactly. It was right next to the mosque. And so after seeing this and after having the dinner conversation a few nights earlier where we saw what was supposed to be Ayman al-Zawahiri's backpack, you know, we're all standing around the platform waiting for the criminals to be trucked in and waiting for those who are going to do the punishments to be trucked in. And here comes these three pickup trucks out of the hills kicking up this huge cloud of dust. And I thought to myself, and I remember writing in my notebook, that this is it. I'm going to see the tall Arab with the $50 million price tag on his head is going to get out of the car. And it was just, at that point, nothing seemed impossible. And I thought for sure that I was going to, you know, that I was going to see bin Laden. It didn't seem bizarre or it didn't seem outlandish at that point. And I think that was just an example and an indication of how totally removed it felt from anything that I'd ever seen in my life.
It also has a macabre sense of theater that, you know, our country has seen also in other days, of watching a public punishment as a way to keep everybody else in line.
Definitely. And actually, everyone in the beginning, as we were all sitting down and preparing and kind of taking our seats, everyone had their camera phones out. And I was also, I thought, this is, I mean, there's no way I'm going to be able to remember all this. I wish, you know, I'll just turn the video function on my camera and let it go. And at that point, they got on the PA system and they said, anyone who's seen using their cameras or using their camera phones will be dealt with accordingly. And here, they're about to start lashing these people. And I've never seen so many cameras go back in people's pockets as quickly as I did.
You say you grew up in a military family. Did you grow up in the States or did you grow up in various places around the world?
No, I mostly in the States, bouncing sort of between Arizona and South Carolina and Northern Virginia.
Do you think your family's experience in the military had an effect on the way that you approached the situation?
I think so. I think that the sort of we all, whether it's my brother as a soldier, whether it's my dad as a general, or whether it's myself, are interested in many of the same things. We just come at them in a very different way. And so we all talk about the same things at dinner. We all read the same sorts of things. And like I said, we just have different ideas about how those problems can be solved and how we want to be interacting with them.
We just have a couple of minutes left, but the idea of solving problems, what do you see in this area as the best approach to try to stem what you write about as sort of endemic violence and inter-warfare between different types of people?
Right. I mean, there are a couple of things. I think that the fact that the rule of law is so flimsy is really a sore point, and is really leaves Pakistan and leaves Pakistan's people very exposed to these various movements who emerge and talk about, you know, establishing justice. This is why over the course of 2006 or 7, 2008, we saw tens of thousands of people, of Pakistanis, middle class Pakistanis, out in the streets. Parading and demanding the rule of law and the independent judiciary and the restoration of the Chief Justice that Musharraf had suspended in 2007. So there is this great desire for something like a rule of law, both at, you know, the top levels and the accountability of local government, I mean of national government, and at the bottom level. And I think when you begin addressing these things, then you begin building trust in the government from local people, which just isn't there. And I think that it's really amazing to see in places like Islamabad, where people have a little bit more money and people can do these things. But people have generators to keep the lights on, they have private security, and they have water pumps because they don't trust that the government will provide lights, water, or security. And so everything has been outsourced and privatized. And I think that so long as that trend continues, you know, Pakistan will remain unstable.
Thank you. I've been speaking with freelance journalist Nicholas Schmidl about his book, To Live or Perish Forever, Two Tumultuous Years in Pakistan. It's published by Henry Holt & Company. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.